Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week in Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top news that is dominating the headlines. The first news is it's been 6 years. 6 years now since the Fukushima disaster, the worst disaster since the 1986 Chernobyl disaster. And the question is, where are we 6 years later? You'll be shocked to find the results. We have just barely begun the basic cleanup operation. How long is it going to take? Minimum of 40 years. It's going to cost tens of billions of dollars just to get rid of all this contaminated water, contaminated nuclear fuel rods, and it is a national disgrace. And it puts into jeopardy the future of nuclear power. Who wants to have a nuclear power plant that generates profits for a while and then drains the national economy because it is basically a raffle for billions of dollars in cleanup funds? And then we're going to go into outer space. The battle of the billionaires is heating up. It's already hot. It's going to get hotter in the coming months. First of all, on one hand, we have NASA with the SLS booster rocket. NASA has a timetable to go to the moon. However, now we have Elon Musk coming in with SpaceX, and he says, no. We're going to go past the moon and on to Mars with a revised timetable. And then we have Jeff Bezos of Amazon, who has his own timetable and his own rockets. His rockets are called the Blue Origins rocket, and he has his sights set on the moon, a permanent lunar base. And the question is, well, what about the economics? What are we going to get with a permanent moon base? What are some of the hazards? What are some of the goals? And what does it mean if we go off to the planet Mars? And then, as I mentioned, President Donald Trump has now jumped into the fray, too. He wants an accelerated program so that by the end of his first term, we will go back to the moon, at least a flyby around the moon, and then perhaps by the end of a hypothetical second term in 2024, perhaps a manned mission to Mars. And then we're going to bring on our special guest today. One friend of mine for the past 30 years has been Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service. He's been a steady source of information for Exploration for the past 30 years. Unfortunately, he passed away last year. So we're going to dedicate today's show to the memory of Michael Marriott, head of the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, D.C. And we're going to rerun an interview that we did with him about the Fukushima disaster. Well, let's just jump right into some of the headlines of the past week. The number one headline is that, well, yes, March marks the sixth year anniversary of the greatest nuclear disaster of modern times since 1986, since the Chernobyl disaster. And where are we 6 years later? You'll be shocked to find the results. First of all, it was 6 years ago that we had a 9.0 earthquake, one of the largest earthquakes ever recorded in the history of the human race, a 9.0 that sent a gigantic tsunami, which overwhelmed all the safety systems of the Fukushima reactor complex. We should also point out that seismology is not an exact science. Seismologists in Japan were not even aware that a small earthquake fall could sustain a 9.0, which would overwhelm all of the safety systems of Fukushima and eventually cause billions of dollars of property damage and kill perhaps 10,000 Japanese people. In fact, one of the saddest things I ever saw on television was the seismologist who went on national television in Japan and apologized to the Japanese people for missing the severity of what could happen off the coast of Japan. And by the way, parenthetically, This reminds me of yet another apology. After we had the disaster in New Orleans with the Katrina hurricane, one of the heads of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which was supposed to monitor the dikes and levees, he came on U.S. national television and apologized. Again, it was an incredible statement, an apology from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers stating that, yes, they were aware of the problem, and yes, they could have taken measures which may have saved the dikes and levees around New Orleans. Well, anyway, this 9.0 earthquake sent a gigantic tsunami which overwhelmed the safety systems at Fukushima. The Fukushima reactors were without any emergency core cooling systems, which is the emergency brake on any nuclear power plant. And not one, not two, but three reactors began to melt. Now, you may say to yourself, well, that was 6 years ago. You figure by now they would have cleaned up the debris, A, and B, start to remove the melted uranium, and C, begin the process of a permanent storage site and a permanent cleanup operation. Where are we on this three-stage process? You'd be shocked. We're at the very beginning of phase one. We don't even know what the melted core looks like. Every time they send a submarine down, the cameras either cannot locate the radioactive debris or get overloaded with radiation. In fact, that's one of the reasons why the cleanup operation has been so agonizingly slow. Workers can only go into the site for a few minutes at a time, receiving deadly amounts of radiation. In fact, there was a camera that was sent down into the water, and the radiation counter on the camera showed that there was enough radiation down there to kill a worker in less than 1 minute. That's how radioactive it is. Well, as a consequence, water does keep on circulating in order to keep the core cool, but the pipes are broken. Therefore, even though fresh water goes in, fresh water goes spilling out again and has to be stored on site in gigantic vats. How much contaminated water per day accumulates? 400 tons, I repeat, every single day, 400 tons of contaminated water spills out of the broken loop. So again, fresh water goes in. Normally, it forms a loop so that the amount of water stays the same. But that loop is broken, and because workers cannot get access to the site, what happens to this extra contaminated water? They simply put it in these gigantic vats, which accumulates at the rate of 400 tons. Now, how many tons of radioactive contaminated water is there at Chernobyl? A staggering 1 million tons. Let me repeat that again so it sinks into you. 1 million tons of contaminated water is stored at the site. Unfortunately, it was a scandal when it was released that some of this radioactive water actually went into the oceans off the coast of Japan, causing tremendous indignation on the part of the Chinese and the Koreans. Basically, they are running out of space. We don't know when, but at a certain time, they will run out of space, and they're not going to know where to put all this contaminated water, which goes into the reactor, gets contaminated, and then spills right out again because the loop is not closed. In addition, there are 4.5 billion gallons of contaminated soil, which is contained in bags. Let me repeat that again so it sinks in. 3.5 billion gallons of contaminated soil, which is put in bags on site. And as far as the land is concerned, 220 acres of land has been deforested and basically put off limits. Now, you may say to yourself, well, so what are they going to do with all this contaminated water when they run out of space? Well, get this. This is a science project. They're going to freeze the soil around Fukushima. Let me repeat that again. We've never seen this in the history of nuclear power. That is, gigantic coolers are being put into place to freeze, freeze the soil around Fukushima to prevent more liquid water from overflowing and eventually going into the ocean. This is a science project in motion. They've never done anything on this scale before. Freezing the soil, hoping that will prevent the contaminated water from spilling into the oceans. And so you may say to yourself, well, the obvious solution is robots. Why don't we, just like Arnold Schwarzenegger, put in robots to clean up the mess and then remove the radioactive fuel? Well, guess what? Robots are totally incapable of cleaning up a reactor. In fact, the United States Pentagon saw an opportunity to showcase advances in robotics by creating a DARPA Grand Challenge. It was the DARPA Grand Challenge that helped to spur the driverless car, which was extremely successful, and we see driverless cars on the roads today. So DARPA said, a branch of the Pentagon, said, let us sponsor yet another contest, a contest to create a robot to clean up Fukushima. Well, on the internet, you can see the results of that contest on video, and it was a disaster. Robots had to basically drive a car, get out of a car. They had to sweep some of the mess and debris with a broom. They had to turn a valve and do things that a five-year-old kid can do. Well, guess what? Almost all the robots failed. And you can see all the robots basically falling over on videos on YouTube. It was a disaster. The South Korean group finally won the prize, barely won the prize. And it shows you how slow the cleanup operation is. So again, step one would be to clean up the debris. Robots are incapable of doing so, and robots that are sent in, sometimes they get fried. Two, cleaning up the melted uranium. Well, submarines have been sent down there, as I mentioned, but we don't even have a picture. I repeat, we don't even have a picture of what the melted uranium looks like. And the core was liquefied. We've never seen this before in the history of nuclear energy. The liquefaction of a core of uranium. Three of them simultaneously liquefied. So we don't know what the melted liquefied uranium looks like sitting on the bottom of the reactor. Now, during the accident, I had my own suggestion. I was on Good Morning America, and I suggested that they should sandbag the reactor. What did the Russians do? They send in the Red Air Force. Teams of helicopters came in with borated sand and dumped the sand and sandbagged the Chernobyl reactor. The Chernobyl reactor had exploded. It was on fire. Radiation was leaking out in gigantic radioactive clouds. It was an emergency, and the Red Air Force came to the rescue. So right now we have a sarcophagus, a gigantic sarcophagus made out of concrete. Inside it is still the radioactive core, and it is still radioactive. It's still not cleaned up at all. The core at Chernobyl still is there since 1986, but at least the accident was contained. My suggestion back then was to dump borated sand and entomb the reactor in a gigantic tomb of sand. Some people are saying, well, maybe we should have done that, because we have this ongoing agony that's going to go on for 40 years. And who knows, maybe one day they'll run out of space to put water on site. And at that point, the accident could start all over again. Well, on a different note, we also have the Battle of the Billionaires. That is, how are we going to go back to the moon, to Mars? Private enterprise or with government taxpayer funds? Well, back during the Cold War, it was obvious that national pride was at stake. And so 5% of the gross domestic product of the United States was spent on the Apollo space program. Let me repeat that again. 5% of the total amount of economic activity produced by the U.S. of A. in the 1960s went into the space program. Well, as you can imagine, that was unsustainable. And sure enough, after we went to the moon, came back from the moon, funding for the space program began to drop. The Vietnam War was kicking in a big way. People were dissatisfied with the state of the government. There was a so-called malaise affecting the government back then. And we forgot about the moon. Well, now it's been 45 years since we last walked on the moon. And now, not one, not two, but three groups have set their sights on the moon and Mars. First of all, we have NASA. NASA with the SLS booster rocket and the Orion space module. They want to go back to the moon perhaps in 2018 with an unmanned probe that'll go in a figure eight motion around the moon. Then, perhaps sometime after 2020, NASA plans to have a manned trip to the moon. Well, in come the politicians, in come the entrepreneurs who say, bah, humbug. We need an accelerated program. First of all, we have Elon Musk and SpaceX with a proven track record, 18 successful launches of its Falcon booster rocket right in a row. And they want to say that, well, we want to go to the moon later this year. That's right. By the end of 2017, Elon Musk wants to send an unmanned probe around the moon, going back to the moon for the first time in 45 years. And then the year after that, next year, a manned mission to circle around the moon. In fact, he already has two volunteers that have paid $80 million each, $80 million each to go around the moon. But the real goal is not the moon at all. The real goal is the planet Mars. And this is where Elon Musk is putting his money on the table. He has said that, yes, even if it takes private funds, he wants to bankroll a manned mission to Mars by 2024, perhaps. Well, not to be outdone, we also have yet another billionaire, Jeff Bezos, owner of Amazon.com and also the Washington Post newspaper. He has his Blue Origins rocket. And he has announced just last week, he announced that the moon is his primary target to create a moon base, a permanent moon base on the moon. Now, with all this talk about going back to the moon, going back to Mars, President Donald Trump has now jumped into the fray. He has asked NASA about the feasibility of an accelerated time frame. That is, by 2020, perhaps going around the moon with a manned flyby of the moon to coincide with the end of his presidency. And if he gets elected for a second term, hypothetically, then perhaps a manned mission to Mars by 2024, by the end of a hypothetical second administration. Well, all of this sounds great, right? But let's get back to the planet Earth. First of all, who's going to pay for all of this? Well, NASA already has a budget for the SLS booster rocket. But, of course, NASA also wants to have a little bit of competition. NASA is also backing Elon Musk's SpaceX program to service the space station. But if Elon Musk wants to go to Mars and the moon, who's going to fund that? Well, Elon Musk has stated that, yes, it's very expensive. It'll cost about $10 billion for a manned mission to the moon. And at that point, he expects a private-public partnership of some sort. So we have a rivalry on one hand from Boeing, which manufactures the SLS booster rocket of NASA, and on the other hand, the Falcon Heavy, the rocket being proposed by Elon Musk. And then, of course, we have Jeff Bezos, who's backing his Blue Origins program. And most people think that, well, these are billionaires. They can simply open up their pocketbook and help to defray the costs of many of these missions. We should also point out that the economics of space travel have also changed. Traditionally, it's been said that it costs about $10,000 to put a pound of anything into orbit around the planet Earth. $10,000 per pound. However, Elon Musk, using a reusable rocket, has been able to drive down the cost to almost $1,000 per pound. Now, that is potentially a game changer, because if we can reduce the cost of space travel, then we can also reduce the cost of sending up humans into outer space. And so a new economics begins to dawn where it makes it possible for private billionaires to fund their own private space program, which would have been unheard of back in the 1960s. And we should also mention, of course, that the problems of radiation, weightlessness, accidents, the problems pile up one after the other once you put humans into outer space. Because robots, of course, are cheap, they don't complain, and most important, they don't have to come back. And as a consequence, robots have been the spearhead which has led the scientific exploration of outer space. Well, now I'd like to answer a few of the emails I get. There's no way that I can answer all the emails that come in, but let me try to group some of them into categories. One category concerns cancer. It is the second leading killer in the United States next to heart disease. And many people think there's maybe a cancer epidemic, but most people say, well, if we had this war on cancer, did we lose the war? I mean, what's the problem? Yes, we lost that war. Back in the 1970s, it was President Richard Nixon who declared a war on cancer. I mean, after all, you simply throw money and you get an atomic bomb. You simply throw money at it and you get a moon rocket. So why not throw money on a war on cancer? Well, there was a problem. We didn't have the genome back in the 1970s. We had no map. We had no map by which to begin the exploration of cancer. Well, now we do have the Human Genome Project, and now we know what cancer is. Believe it or not, we didn't even know what cancer was back in the 1970s during the war on cancer. Is it caused by viruses? Is it caused by pollution? Is it caused by bad genes and heredity? What causes cancer? Well, we now know all of the above. But basically, cancer, we now know, is a disease of the genes. Yes, viruses contribute. Yes, radiation, poisons contribute. Yes, all of the above contribute. But what do they do? The bottom line is, they create mutations in our genes, four major mutations in four major genes is enough to cause cancer. Now, this alone explains many mysteries. For example, why does it take so many decades for cancer to form? Let me give you an example. If you have a sunburn as a child, a very severe sunburn as a child, 30, 40 years later, you may have skin cancer at that very same spot where you had a very bad sunburn as a child. Why? Well, it's because it takes on average four or so major mutations in our genes, which takes time. So when you got that nasty sunburn as a child, that was mutation number one. And years later, maybe mutation number two is when you took a ride in the countryside and got another sunburn. Maybe mutation number three was purely accidental. Maybe mutation number four was caused by some kind of chemical. So it takes a sequence of several genes in order to create cancer. Now, if we know what cancer is, then why can't we cure it? Well, first of all, it is a cancer of the genes. And how many types of cancer are there? Thousands. In fact, the Human Genome Project was trivial compared to the Cancer Genome Project, which the government is now embarking upon. An encyclopedia of all the different kinds of ways in which these four more or less important genes are mutated. And in other words, cancer is not just one disease at all. It's four major mutations in either the oncogenes or the tumor suppressor genes, genes which either accelerate or stop the growth of cancer. So in other words, cancer turned out to be a lot more sophisticated and a lot more complicated than previously thought. Now, of course, if cancer is a disease of the genes, why not attack it at the genomic level or use something called targeted therapies? Well, that's where all the excitement is right now. The human body has a feeble ability, a limited ability to recognize cancer, so why not extract immune cells from the body and then grow them and strengthen them in the laboratory and then re-inject them back into the body? That's being done right now. It's called immunotherapy. It's the hottest thing now in cancer research. Another possibility is genetic therapy. Gene therapy had a lot of publicity 10 years ago, and it's since been kind of like sputtering along, but now there have been some solid gains made in gene therapy. Gene therapy is when you take a virus, you remove the deadly genes of the virus, so it's harmless, and you put the good gene into the cancer, which then infects you with the correct gene. So gene therapy is another very promising avenue by which one day we may be able to literally cure cancer. Nanotechnology is also coming into play. It turns out nanotechnology allows us the ability to target individual cancer cells. This, of course, is the holy grail, to be able to knock off cancer cells one by one. And nanotechnology is a very infant science, but it gives us that ability. In fact, we now realize that the greatest nanotechnologist of all time is Mother Nature. Mother Nature uses nanotechnology every single day. And the question is, can we also harness that technology? Think about it for a moment. Mother Nature can take a bunch of French fries and hamburgers and turn it into a baby in 9 months. That is amazing. Mother Nature is able to, first of all, break down all the proteins inside French fries and hamburgers, reassemble them in terms of nutrients, and then piece by piece start to build DNA molecules which can absorb these nutrients to create a human baby, which in turn consists of millions upon millions of cells, each cell in turn programmed correctly. That is the work of a master nanotechnologist called Mother Nature. Well, that completes the first part of Exploration. In the second part of Exploration, we're going to rerun an earlier interview about Fukushima that I conducted with Michael Marriott, the director of the Nuclear Information Resource Service, who passed away last year. So in other words, I'd like to dedicate these comments to Michael Marriott. He was a real friend of Exploration for 30 years, and he gave us timely reports about the progress and mishaps of nuclear power and nuclear power plants. And so once again, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to rerun an earlier interview I conducted with Michael Marriott concerning the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. And as you can tell from the interview, we haven't really changed much. We haven't really had much progress in terms of that reactor. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we gave a sum up as to what's happening on the 6th anniversary of the Fukushima disaster in Japan. But I'd like to, in the second half of Exploration, run an earlier tape that I did with Michael Marriott. Michael Marriott passed away last year. Unfortunately, he left his work unfinished. His work was to bring a halt to nuclear power, concentrating on the nuclear waste problem. He was the executive director of NIRS, the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, D.C., which is one of the main clearinghouses of information concerning the fate of nuclear energy. And he was a friend of exploration for 30 years. Off and on, we had his voice on these airwaves giving us a sum up as to what's happening with nuclear energy. And so today, in his honor, I'd like to rerun an earlier tape and just remember that things really haven't changed much at Fukushima at all. We still have yet to begin a proper cleanup of the nuclear reactor. We have yet to even locate where the nuclear debris is concentrated at the bottom of the nuclear power plants. And we still have the radioactive water, which is accumulating at the rate of 400 tons per day on site. And so things really haven't changed much in 6 years. The main part of the cleanup, that is cleaning up the melted core, hasn't even begun yet. And it's going to be about 40 more agonizing years into the future before we finish that cleanup. And so once again, our special guest today is the late Michael Marriott, and we're going to be rerunning an earlier interview with him concerning the Fukushima disaster. Well, once again, our special guest today is Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, D.C. And today we're talking about nuclear energy. What's the status of the Fukushima disaster? What might have happened in the Philippines if there was a nuclear power plant within the gun sights of this gigantic, monstrous typhoon? And also global warming. Will nuclear energy save us from global warming? These are the questions we're going to be asking Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service, one of the main clearinghouses concerning nuclear energy. Well, with us on the line is Michael Marriott of NIRS. So, Michael, first of all, tell us, what is NIRS?
Well, NIRS is the acronym for Nuclear Information and Resource Service. We're an organization that was founded in 1978 to sort of help be the network center and sort of coordinating center for the what was then and is today a very decentralized grassroots movement for safe, clean energy and against nuclear power. And over the years, we've evolved. We now initiate campaigns, and our goal has expanded a little bit, too, in that we are working very hard to build the nuclear-free, carbon-free energy future that our planet both needs and deserves. You can find us at www.nirs.org.
Okay, so Michael, let's now talk about the Fukushima disaster, which is still ongoing. And first of all, tell us a little bit, sum up what exactly happened during the accident. And tell us about the state of the reactor today.
Well, back on March 11th, 2011, people across the world were woken up, at least those of us in the Western Hemisphere, with news that there had been a major earthquake off the coast of Japan, followed by a tsunami. And that was followed by a loss of electric power, not surprisingly, to a bunch of nuclear reactors, three of which at the Fukushima Daiichi locale, began melting down. The fourth didn't melt down because there was no fuel in the reactor at the time. And two other reactors at the site, which were separate, they were physically separated from the other four, experienced a number of problems, but ended up at least not melting down. So what we had was a scenario that I don't think anybody working in this field had ever envisioned. Three nuclear reactors melting down at the same time, coupled with severe problems at four reactor fuel storage pools, which were located at these sites. And we had a series of hydrogen explosions, which blew off the top of the reactor buildings, created all kinds of mess. And so now, approaching 3 years later, that's what we still have, three reactors that have melted down with the molten fuel somewhere underneath them. The authorities and the utility involved, TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power, they don't know exactly where that molten fuel is, too radioactive to try to get to, of course. And then we have, even though, this has happened, quite a long time ago, even though a lot of the fuel is still on the bottom of the, somewhere underneath the reactors, everything still needs to be kept cool. And so TEPCO built sort of a makeshift cooling system that runs through these reactors that leaks. And the large amounts of water run through, become, through the various reactors, it becomes radioactive, it leaks into the groundwater, and rainwater from, obviously from rain. Fukushima sort of at the bottom of a hill, rainwater comes down the hill, runs through the plant, it becomes radioactive. And pretty soon they noticed that immense amounts of water are actually coming through that site, becoming radioactive and moving on into the nearby harbor.
So, Michael, the main worry there is that highly radioactive wastewater could then pour into the harbor and eventually affect China, Korea, and perhaps other Pacific nations. So what's known about how much radiation is actually flowing into the water, and how dangerous is that?
Well, it's not clear, at least to me, how much radiation we're talking about. We know how much water we're talking about. It's something like 400 million gallons a day flowing in there. The water, this is not, highly molten fuel going. So, the water's picking up radiation. So the radiation levels are not considered highly radioactive. But what happens is that there's a current that tends to keep the reactor, sort of a circular current in the harbor, and water tends to just sort of go around in a circle there, and the Japanese officials have used that as a nothing more than an excuse, really, to argue that water and the radiation, in particular radiation, has not gone beyond the harbor. And of course, that's absolute nonsense. Water is going from there into the Pacific Ocean, probably not as much as some people think, but certainly a lot more than the Japanese government seems to think. Fish come into the harbor and swim back out again. They're not really deterred by this circular current. The other forms of sea life come in and out, and so it's very clear that, in fact, all of this, the radiation that has been coming down for the last couple of years and continues to come down is going out in the Pacific Ocean. And the question is, what are the impacts? What will be the impacts? Pacific Ocean is a big place, and even this amount of water is pretty small compared in volume compared to the entire Pacific Ocean. But
now,
certainly an effect on seafood and other factors.
Now, the utility has suggested some rather unorthodox ways to contain all this rainwater. One is to build a wall of ice that is import lots of refrigerators to basically freeze the ground so that you build up an artificial barrier against all this rainwater, which is washing this radiation into the harbor. What are your thoughts about this? It's never been tried before on this kind of scale.
Right. Well, it was actually a process I'd never even heard of before, although I looked into it a bit, and it has been used as a blocking mechanism in a few places in the world, although, as you say, in a much smaller scale. I have yet to talk to somebody who thinks this is a good idea or who thinks it will work. But obviously, you know, when there's somebody willing to sell something, you know, somebody will buy it, I guess. I think this idea really is more evidence that Tokyo Electric Power is in over its head. And, you know, this is a company, it's an electric utility. They made their money by selling electricity. This is not a major engineering firm, and I think that shows. And I think that's behind some of the recent efforts we've seen to, you know, bring some more international experience in to Fukushima to help out with this accident, because it's pretty clear that, you know, Tokyo Electric Power itself is floundering.
Now, some people have said that if there is another earthquake, it doesn't have to be a big one, even a minor earthquake, it could tip the reactor over, and the accident can start up all over again. So what are your thoughts about the fact that earthquakes happen all the time in Japan, and it wouldn't take much to tip this reactor over? What are your thoughts?
Right. Well, I'm assuming you're talking about the Unit 4 reactor there, which was the explosion. They hit that reactor, sort of crippled the building, put it at a slant. I mean, you know, all the reactors there are in pretty bad shape, and if you want to talk about, you know, which reactor, you know, we still believe is the most dangerous, it's Unit 3. But Unit 4 has gotten the most attention. And they have put some effort into bolstering the structure of that reactor. They had to do that for two reasons. One is that obviously the building was in very sorry shape and you know, noticeably leaning. Two is that they decided that's the building because that building had not experienced a meltdown. There had been no fuel in the reactor core itself. That would be the starting point for cleanup, and so this month is when they're planning to begin removing the fuel from the fuel pool in that building. So they had to bolster it up quite a bit. They claim, they meaning the utility and Japanese authorities, claim that it could withstand at least a direct 6.0 earthquake. But I don't know if they're right or not, and I hope we don't find out. But, you know, as you say, you know, this is an earthquake-prone place, and I think it is better to get the fuel out of this building as soon as safely possible, you know, before the next one hits, because in Japan, you're sort of always waiting for the next one to hit.
Right. In fact, just recently, there was a 5.5 earthquake that rattled Tokyo. Quite a few people were shaken out of bed, in fact. It was so great. And that was just right outside Tokyo. Now, some people say, well, why don't they simply send in workers and robots and just get rid of this melted core, and why don't they just repair the whole operation? But tell us about the conditions that the workers have to work in, given the fact that it's highly radioactive, and robots have proven to be a huge disappointment.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, these are unprecedented conditions. I mean, we've never tried, you know, at Chernobyl, which was the, you know, major nuclear accident before this one, 1986, it exploded. The Soviet Union at the time, I mean, there were 600,000 people. They became liquidators, and their job was to run up. They could stand up for about 15 seconds and take, you know, and move some debris. 600,000 people, and they have been exposed to a, you know, very high risk of cancer. A lot of them have died from it since. At Fukushima, you know, they don't have liquidators. They have utility employees and contractors and subcontractors. But yet the conditions, the radiation levels where the core is, where the, you know, underneath the building, are just as comparable as Chernobyl. In some ways, it's probably harder because you've got, as we said, we had three simultaneous meltdowns. We've got three reactor cores that cannot be approached by people. And you can't even get to the core in a protective suit. I mean, you have to be away from it. And meanwhile, you have so much debris throughout what's left of these buildings that the robots they send in, find it really difficult to maneuver around. I mean, they did get some in. I've seen some photos of inside the buildings, and some of the floors actually surprisingly are look almost normal, but they try to get anywhere near where the fuel is, and they're blocked, and the cameras go bad. The radiation levels, the radiation film, of course, doesn't work well together. So it's a monumental, unprecedented task, and it's going to take decades before this is.
In fact,
this story is over.
The official estimate is 40 years. 40 years, an estimate made by the utility itself. So we're going to be agonizing about this for decades and decades to come, right? Our grandkids are going to be learning about the cleanup operation.
Well, that's right. And I think 40 years may be optimistic. But when you look at the reality is we're almost 3 years out. They are just beginning this month to begin removing the first fuel rod from the first pool. That removal of the fuel rods from that pool, if all goes well, scheduled to take a year and a half. Well, we got three more fuel pools after that, one of which at Unit 3 is in a much worse condition. And then we got these reactor cores after that. And as I said, they don't even know exactly where the fuel is. And that's going to be extraordinarily highly radioactive for, decades, centuries, really.
Okay.
So, this is a... This process, this is going to be with us the rest of our lives.
Okay, well, change the subject a little bit. Some people claim that no matter how bad nuclear is, there's something worse, and that is global warming. In fact, Dr. James Hansen, who's one of the leading figures pushing the global warming theory, has pretty much said that, perhaps the white knight could be nuclear power. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, Dr. Hansen, along with three of his colleagues, recently wrote an open letter, what he called an open letter to environmentalists, urging us to reconsider and support new nuclear power as a means of addressing climate change. And Dr. Hansen is an esteemed climate scientist. The entire world owes him a debt of gratitude for his work on climate, and especially in effectively warning that we have to do something about climate. But climate and energy are two different issues. They're two different areas of expertise. And unfortunately, Dr. Hansen's expertise doesn't seem to extend to energy. Nuclear power is not a solution to climate change. It never has been. Even if nuclear power were safe, let's take the safety issue off the table for a moment. Even if nuclear power didn't create radioactive waste, we'll take that issue off the table for a moment. The reality is we couldn't build enough nuclear power plants to play any kind of meaningful role in addressing climate change in any kind of time period that would matter. And that's what's so puzzling about his argument. He wants us to build a lot of nuclear reactors between, and by a lot, I mean an astonishing amount, well more than has ever been contemplated over the next 20 years. And what we're seeing in reality is the collapse of the nuclear power industry in the U.S. We're not seeing new reactors. We're seeing new reactor projects abandoned. In fact, just yesterday in Texas, two more proposed new reactors that were supposed to be part of this nuclear renaissance that was supposed to begin, around 2008, 2009. Two more reactors in North Central Texas were canceled. The nuclear renaissance, at one point, there were plans to build more than 30 new reactors in this country starting this decade. We're down to 4. And the utilities are realizing that they don't want nuclear power. They can't afford nuclear power. On an economic basis, nuclear power can no longer compete. And we're seeing that not only with new plants, which we knew were extraordinarily expensive, but even operating plants. In 2013 alone, we've had 5 reactor shutdowns of operating reactors. That's unprecedented. We've never had that in 1 year before. And we believe, NIRS believe, and a lot of other people believe, in fact, even Forbes magazine last week had an article on this, this is a trend that's going to accelerate. We're going to see more reactor shutdowns next year and the year after that. The nuclear industry is getting smaller, not bigger. Now, Dr. Hansen espouses new types of reactors, generally something called small modular reactors and integral fast reactors. These are reactors that exist on paper and in laboratories. They don't actually exist in the real world. There's never been a full-scale prototype built. And the idea that we are somehow going to take these reactor designs that exist on paper in somebody's lab and build hundreds, if not thousands, of them before the mid-century, when we have competing fuels that are much, much cheaper and just as clean, if not cleaner, than nuclear power, just makes no sense. And by just as clean or cleaner, I'm talking about solar and wind.
Okay, now, Michael, given the fact that well-known individuals are now jumping into the fray, Bill Gates recently jumped into this debate as well, talking about backyard nuclear power plants. Instead of having chicken in every pot and a car in every garage, he wants to have a nuclear power plant in everyone's backyard. So explain the logic behind backyard nukes.
Well, the belief is, and yeah, Bill Gates, this is another version of the small modular reactor. The idea behind them is that if you make them, you know, relatively small, and of course, yeah, they are much bigger than backyard, but if you make relatively small and you can make them modular, meaning that they can be cranked out in a factory instead of fully custom built at a site, that maybe you can make them cheaper. But the problem is the reason reactors got so large to begin with was, you know, the well-known phrase, economies of scale. The early reactors built in this country and everywhere else were very small. And the utilities quickly realized that they couldn't build them small and economically, so they ramped up the size. The same factor seems like it's going to hold true now, and I say seems like because, again, these reactors don't actually exist. They're dreams on paper. And they're also too late because when we want to talk about backyard power sources, well, we have them. It's called rooftop solar. And there's a rooftop solar system being installed in this country every 4 minutes now, 2013. In 2 years, that's going to be every 90 seconds. We're going to have a new rooftop solar unit going up in this country.
Well, Michael, these so-called backyard nuclear power plants have gotten a certain amount of publicity. So let us now elaborate on this. So tell us a little bit about the history of this. And there's a certain person called David Crane, head of one of the largest utilities, Energy. Tell us about his position.
David Crane is ahead of it. And you know, David Crane is not some anti-nuclear advocate. In fact, we've been fighting a proposed nuclear plant in Texas, a different one in Texas, that he initiated. Now, he got out of the plan. He got energy out of the project immediately after Fukushima. That ended nuclear power for him. But he recently said, he recently told Business Week magazine that distributed energy generation, and by distributed energy generation, we actually mean backyard power, rooftop solar, solar on top of, you know, Walmart warehouses and that kind of thing, small wind farms, even a backyard wind turbine, that is going to, in the same way, this is what Crane told Business Week, in the same way that cell phone use overtook landline use, distributed generation is going to overtake the current and traditional utility model of big baseload generation coming from dozens or hundreds of miles away, bringing power into your home. In the same way and in the same kind of time frame, this is going to happen. Now, if you think about that time frame, it's less than 20 years. Our electric system model is going to be completely different, and we are going to be relying far more on rooftop solar, on wind, on other types of renewables that can be done locally and nearby. And you know, not the big power plants are ever going to go away, but they're going to play the subsidiary role. They're not going to play the major role anymore.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And we ran a broadcast that we previously recorded with Michael Marriott, Executive Director of the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, who passed away last year. So unfortunately, we're going to be dedicating our comments today in the memory of Michael Marriott, who for the past 30 years has been a friend of Exploration. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.